Hello, thanks for downloading this podcast of The Takeaway. I'm John Hockenberry. We're on the radio, too. Radio, you know, that thing with the crank in your emergency kit. Radio. Well, it sounds a bit like this. This is The Takeaway. I'm John Hockenberry. Thanks so much for listening, and it is a thrill to be broadcasting into Chicago, the city where I went to college, University of Chicago. I lived at 55th Street and South Shore Drive. That was in the 70s. In the 80s, Chicago was a remarkable place to come of age as a reporter. And I couldn't be more excited about welcoming folks from Chicago into our public radio family and this lively conversation that can only be spiced up with voices from WBEZ Chicago. I'll talk more about all of that in a blog post you can read at thetakeaway.org later today. But in the 1980s, the world was just starting to pick up the pace of change in politics and technology and demographics, and Chicago was really on the leading edge of all of it. The divisions between the frenetic urban people of Chicago's famous glass towers, its vibrant industrial culture, and its infamous housing projects contrasted sharply with the tranquility of Western rural towns. As a regional reporter for NPR, I often crossed the border between Chicago and the flatlands around it, stepping from the Democratic machine din of Chicago into the quiet, conservative, solidly Republican country out near DeKalb, Wheaton, towns like Sandwich, Spring Grove, and Yorkville. Republican country. And for a very long time, in fact, while I was a reporter in Chicago, this was Hastert country. Denny Hastert, the man who eventually became Speaker of the House of Representatives, hails from the town of Yorkville, where he was the wrestling coach and a teacher for two decades. Today, Yorkville is grappling with the ugly allegations surrounding the former speaker, a once-beloved coach, teacher, and representative there. Hastert has been charged with perjury and a bank transaction crime. He has not been formally charged with sexual assault, but alleged victims from his time as a Yorkville wrestling coach have started to come forward. Tony Arnold is state politics reporter for WBEZ Chicago Public Media. He went down to Yorkville last week and joins me now. Tony, welcome. What have you found?
Hi, John. Good to be here. Well, I found in Yorkville, it's funny because, like, in the political world, the name Hastert and Yorkville just kind of go together. They're just synonymous. It was always well known that covering Hastert that, you know, he's the coach from Yorkville who turned politician and became one of the most powerful men in the country and one of the longest serving speakers of the House at that. The fact that he was able to keep it for so long and then still be able to, you know, bring things back to Yorkville and pitch things to the people there just kind of added to this whole, I guess, mystique of Hastert and the power that he had, in addition to just his own popularity there. It's a very small town. It doesn't have a town square or anything like that. And it's really been this town that's been changing because it's been one of the fastest growing areas of the country for the last decade or so. And so you're seeing this kind of whole cultural change there within the town of Yorkville, which only kind of adds to what's going on here with Hastert, the change in perception of one of the most famous and really longtime beloved politicians.
And I gather that how quickly all this unraveled has both stunned and resigned people to, we're going to just have to deal with this, I guess.
It really has. And that's because, you know, in the political world, Hastert was always kind of the quiet, clean-cut guy. And so the fact that now these are coming out, talking to people, that you're seeing them grapple with a change in perception here. Last week I was going to, there were a lot of garage sales, so I was kind of garage sale hopping from one to another to talk to people about this. And JoLynn Sedgwick had a very slow garage sale, I'd say. And so I spent a lot of time talking to her. And, you know, she was saying that these allegations go a little bit beyond being surprised. It's more just being really disheartened and disappointed, she said.
It's definitely going to be a little bit of a scar or a stain compared to what it was. You know, it used to be, oh, our Speaker of the House is from Yorkville. We're so proud of that. And, well, not as much anymore, so.
And around the region, I think this goes far and wide, people thinking about what are the implications. And, you know, it reminds me of a Sinclair Lewis story in some sense.
Yeah, and I think the other thing that you're getting with this is not only that he had this reputation for so long of being, you know, the Yorkville guy that was so good, but also just politically, I think that he struck a good balance for the district because it was, as you said earlier, that it's a very rural district. It's mostly north central Illinois, so it goes beyond Chicago's suburbs. It's more of just a little bit of the exurbs, and then from there, just sort of the prairie farmland moving west toward the Mississippi. You know, getting to what you were saying before, it is this land of conservatism, and that's something that I think you're seeing that politically some people were really struggling with. I talked to John Tinsley, who is eating lunch in a park there in Yorkville, and he's from the same area. He's not quite from Yorkville, but he's from very close by. And, you know, he said this is something that is really, I think, a hard time for him and his friends, which was just the politics of this, how he thought politically matched how Hastert acted. So here's what John Tinsley had to say.
I know he's not the first person to have some allegation brought out about things that has happened with him, but obviously it is devastating, I think, for a lot of people, you know, because he had support for many years.
You know, Tinsley there is speaking about, you know, the impression that, you know, this is the kind of thing that happens to, you know, the Rostenkowskis, the people in Chicago associated with the Democratic machine, or the craziness that goes on in the state house, the governor's mansion there in Springfield, with the problems that have happened in the state house, not in this area.
Exactly. You know, Illinois and Chicago has this reputation for being corrupt. This being the sex scandal draws that distinction here. And that's something that the state is not used to dealing with. I can't think of many examples off the top of my head in recent memory. So the fact that this is that draws that distinction and it hits someone who had already retired, I think adds to what is this legacy going to be for Hastert in the area, in addition to the changing nature of Yorkville and the area around there, which just booms in population. And then you add to it that there's just been a few more allegations lately about just how many people have been abused by Hastert, just how many victims are there. And all of these are sort of coming from sources that it just makes you wonder how big is this going to get? How many people in Yorkville knew about this? And I was asking a lot of people if there has been a whisper campaign at all over the years, and everyone was saying no. This has really been a big shock for a lot of people there.
Well, Tony Arnold, thanks so much for speaking with us. He's state politics reporter for WBEZ, Chicago Public Media. The first of many conversations, I hope, Tony.
That sounds good. Thanks, John.
How does one evaluate the record of a warfighting unit that conducts its operations in secret and officially doesn't even exist? SEAL Team 6 is the blackest of the black ops units deployed by the Pentagon. It's also pretty famous for being so secret. Responsible for killing Osama bin Laden in 2011, that raid became the subject of a movie, Zero Dark Thirty, and SEAL Team 6 gets a part in the movie about the rescue of Captain Richard Phillips from Somali pirates as well. Everything it does is behind the operational curtain of special ops, but an article published over the weekend in the New York Times attempts to piece together a more complete history of SEAL Team 6, a unit that has conducted many more raids than these two. Nicholas Kulish is a correspondent for our partner, the New York Times. He helped write the article. He joins me now. Nick, welcome.
Thanks for having me, John.
So what was the genesis of SEAL Team 6 and its ilk in the special ops culture of the Pentagon?
Well, you know, if you'll recall, there was the disaster trying to free the hostages in Iran that took place during the hostage crisis there. And we already had the Delta Force at that time, which was the Army's Tier 1 Special Mission Unit. And it was decided that the Navy would get involved as well. So they picked up a Vietnam veteran named Richard Marcinko and tasked him with forming his own special unit.
And what was the mission here? To do things against the conventional wisdom, to break the rules, or was there specific guidelines?
I think the idea was that for certain things, especially hostage rescues, for chasing down loose nuclear weapons, if terrorists got a hold of one, we needed to have some really, you know, special guys, the cream of the crop, that could do those very limited, very difficult jobs.
What do former members say about being a part of this unit? Was it something they're proud of, something they have questions about?
I think that everyone who served is proud of having been in the unit, both because of how elite it is, and because I would say the vast majority of what they do is, you know, really great, calls for a great deal of bravery and valor. I think that several of the people that I've spoken to have also expressed some concern about what kinds of missions they're being asked to do, whether they're being asked to do too many, particularly in Afghanistan, and whether the culture had changed too much.
This seems to employ a tactic of, not unlike what Colin Powell used to call flood the zone, where you really come in with an overwhelming amount of force, which can have certain kinds of consequences if the mission itself requires a slightly more surgical approach. Have they gotten in trouble with these sort of tactics?
Well, as we learned by reporting this article, you know, there's not as much accountability and oversight as you would probably expect and as you would get for a conventional military unit. As one senior official had told us, JSOC, meaning the Joint Special Operations Command, investigates JSOC, and that's part of the problem. And so if you're always kind of deciding for yourself whether you made any mistakes, then you tend to grade yourself on a pretty lenient curve.
Is that to say that there have been missions or haven't been missions that have gone terribly wrong?
I mean, there have definitely been missions with civilian casualties, which, of course, you know, we all understand is a part of war. There have also been missions where, you know, members of SEAL Team 6 have gotten killed, where, you know, one wishes that they hadn't. I think that part of the issue here, though, is that there's so little transparency that to judge how the team is doing and to judge whether it's being used effectively is almost impossible from the outside.
Can you detect that people who have been on SEAL Team 6 bear a certain kind of post-operative baggage or weight or a sense of being traumatized by the experience at all? Or is there something about being in this unit that actually makes it easier to move on with your life?
I mean, they would certainly say that they are prone less to post-traumatic stress disorder. In terms of traumatic brain injury in particular, that's something they deal with a lot. That's been found to be something that that this community, I think, is dealing with even more so than the conventional troops.
How tight are these soldiers in both their operation and post-op?
They're an incredibly, incredibly tightly bonded team, but it's also almost like a collection of alpha males. And so every single person on that team, I think, believes that they're the best. So there's a lot of clashes. There's a lot of personality issues that you've seen come out a little bit in public with some of these books and some of these specials and some of these movies where, you know, where the guys just have a hard time watching one another, you know, praying before the cameras.
Oh, that's so interesting. Nicholas Kulish is a correspondent for our partner, the New York Times. He helped write an article that was published over the weekend that attempts to give a complete history of SEAL Team 6. Thanks so much, Nicholas.
Appreciate it. Thanks for having me, John.
You're listening to The Takeaway from WNYC and PRI Public Radio International in collaboration with The New York Times and WGBH Boston Public Radio.
The notoriety of Caitlyn Jenner may have started some conversations about being transgender, but it's an outside detail for schools that have been dealing with gender identity for years. Pictures of Jenner and other profile members of the transgender community are topics for show and tell in a conversation that has already started. As kids as young as 6, 7, and 8 years old start to question their gender identity, schools have to decide how to guide and support families. Q Daly is a third grader at the Brooklyn News School in New York. Q was born a girl but now lives his life as a boy. Yasmin Khan, a reporter here at WNYC, found a story of change and curiosity unfolding quietly and without spectacle, benefiting mightily from the always refreshing wisdom of children.
Well, Q Daly is a pretty happy, confident boy, third grade boy. He was born a girl, and he decided to make the transition to identifying as a boy going back to the second grade. It kind of happened on and off in the second grade. But he had these questions about his gender going back to age 3.5, 4 years old, his mom said, you know, starting with clothes. It often starts, I think, with clothes. I don't want to wear dresses, and I don't want to wear pink or sparkles or anything like that. And there was a point where his mom borrowed some boy clothes from a friend. His dad cut his hair short at the end of first grade. And as his dad says, a whole light came out. And this is how Q describes actually identifying as a boy.
It feels like instead of a dead flower, a growing flower.
Oh, that's remarkable. That's amazing.
So something obviously deep inside him that started from a very young age. But this is his first school year in the third grade identifying as a boy.
And how does that manifest itself in the course of his day?
Pretty naturally. His third grade teacher told me that she went up to him on the first day of school, didn't know exactly maybe what would happen over the summer between second grade, third grade. She went up to him and said, "Hi, what's your name?" He said, "Q." And she said, "Okay, you're Q." And they, his teachers described that from the very beginning, they just saw him as a boy, as who he was. And he is very comfortable in his class. He loves his school. His classmates are as the school social worker puts it, his classmates are totally unfazed by this. They're downright blasé about it. I think that, you know, for Q, he has a best friend, Billy. They're still friends. They were friends when Q was a girl, identified as a girl, and now. And their friendship hasn't really changed. They still play the same way, and they still connect over important issues, like Michael Jackson, apparently. They're, you know, Michael Jackson fanatics. So it doesn't matter to them, I guess. And, you know, the gender expression, it just matters sort of what they can do during recess and after school and how they interact in the classroom.
Well, here's how Billy responded when an intrusive reporter named Yasmin asked the question of what's this all about?
I didn't want to tell a lot of people. I just wanted to tell my mom, my dad, and my brother because it would make a mistake if we had a play date and they would call in a machine. That would be a little bit of a mistake.
And that was – I love that. I love that cut from Billy where he's obviously just – he wanted to follow the rules. He wanted to get it right, you know. And I think that for a lot of the kids, if they can put it in the right framework, they're fine with it.
And where the boys go, Q goes.
Mostly in the lunchroom, girls sit on one side of the table and the boys sit on the other. But I usually sit in the middle.
That's so great.
I know. And actually, he told me. He said he feels like – being a boy, he has more freedom now to be friends with boys and girls. Maybe it's just because of who he is inside. He feels like he's, you know, able to be more social, or he just can sort of ride that line in between the two.
Now, a lot of people would be asking, listening to this story, how is this different from a kid wanting to change their name? Maybe somebody, you know, wanting to change their identity, wearing a, you know, fireman's suit to school every day as, you know, kindergartners, first graders, second graders are wont to do. How does this become something that really crosses a line here?
Yeah, and I think a lot of parents maybe are asking themselves that question too if they're confronting these issues of gender. But first of all kids experiment with gender and gender roles.
Mm-hmm.
But the answer is, I'm told, from at least a psychotherapist that heads the Gender and Family Project at the Ackerman Institute. The way he described it to me was this comes from deep inside. You know it's not a phase after a few months and it continues to persist. And the children are consistent with how they want to express themselves at home, on the playground, at school, to their neighbors. And that's what's been happening with Q. It's been really years now that he's expressed wanting to be a boy and has then identified as a boy. And he is the same at school as he is at home.
And it's amazing to me, and I should disclose that I have a kindergartner at this same school in Brooklyn who doesn't know about Q, but I imagine would be just as unfazed as some of the kids that you talk to. But the leadership at this school, and here's Anna Allenbrook, who's the principal and Q's principal, talks about observing exactly what you described.
I think 10 years ago I would have said, she's a girl, she goes to the girls' bathroom, you know. But I think society has changed in the last 10 years, and therefore I think we've all been made much more aware of this continuum.
And I just want to remind people, I have experience with this school. You've done a lot of reporting out of this school. There's nothing – I mean, there are certain things that are special about this school, but from the outside, and if you were in the hallways, you wouldn't think there was anything exotic or strange or – progressive particularly about this school at all. It's just a regular old school on a street in Brooklyn.
Yeah, regular old public school.
Exactly.
And I will just say that I feel like, you know, he could be having a different experience at another school for sure. Yeah. And it starts with using the preferred name and preferred pronoun, actually. And just that, you know, like at this school, they validate Q's gender identity. And there are schools that do not do that. And schools have to first learn not to assume the gender, and then they have to come up with some actual changes. So in this case, with Q, they had to confront the issue of the bathroom. And Q started using the boys' bathroom on his own in the second grade. And this is elementary school, so in this school, the issue doesn't come up every day, but if you're in high school and you have a sports team or locker rooms, it's the same sort of idea that you want to give the child or the teenager the opportunity to, you know, play on a team or use the bathroom locker room of their gender identity. They're living their life you know, a certain way.
Well, let's check fourth grade, fifth grade, sixth grade. There's lots of story to come. Yasmin Khan, thanks so much.
Thank you.
To see photos of Yasmin's reporting, you can visit thetakeaway.org.
The Takeaway is supported by Citrix, creator of GoToMeeting, connecting people and businesses in face-to-face online meetings from any device, featuring a personalized meeting room for a custom look. Learn more at GoToMeeting.com.
So we're at halftime here at The Takeaway. You want to stick around for the second half, of course. A reminder, we are on Twitter at The Takeaway. Please do follow us there. And you can follow me at Jay Hockenberry. I'll answer your tweets. What you're listening to is really only made possible by those who contribute to public radio. If you do, thank you. If you don't, please think about giving whatever you can to your local public radio station. They need it, and you'll feel good about being part of a community that values stories like this. What is left to do at the U.S. Supreme Court in 2015? Plenty. The big cases get decided last, and that's certainly the case this term. Eric Citron, he's a partner at Goldstein and Russell, a leading Supreme Court firm and a specialist in appellate practice. He's also a former clerk to Justices Sandra Day O'Connor and Elena Kagan. Citron says the unpredictability of this court might best be seen in the capital punishment case Glossop v. Gross.
The death penalty has fallen out of public debate, but it is at the heart of one that division that's run through the court, and it was a very contentious oral argument. In part because the actual issue in the case is whether a new drug that's being used as the first of three drugs in a three drug protocol is adequate to the task. But the conservative justices on the court really view the effort to attack this particular protocol as an attack head on on the death penalty. And so it was a very contentious oral argument. Mm. I think it's hard to predict what will happen, but the court is locked in a scientific debate that it probably doesn't feel too comfortable in, and is mostly deciding whether or not it wants to meddle in how the states try to conduct the death penalty, or whether to say basically we said the death penalty is constitutional and the states will have to figure it out. That could be as contentious as any case the court has to decide.
How about King v. Burwell, which is the case that the administration calls a technicality on the Affordable Care Act, but in fact, in oral arguments, it was very, very contentious, and it seems like there's way more than meets the eye here.
Sure, there's an enormous amount at stake over a very small provision in the law. The dispute is about whether or not states that don't set up their own exchanges to facilitate the health care law nonetheless get subsidies for their citizens if they can't afford the full price of health care. The way the law is written, it seems on its very face to suggest that the subsidies are available to a state that sets up its own exchange, an exchange set up by the state, I think is the term in the statute. But the federal government fills in for lots of the states when they haven't set up their own exchange, and it seems like the manifest intention of the law was to provide subsidies for everybody. I mean, it is called the Affordable Care Act, and we all know it as part of the universal health care debate. It's quite possible that the court will decide that only states that have set up their own exchanges get the subsidies, in which case a very large number of citizens are going to have trouble claiming the subsidies on their tax returns from the IRS. At oral argument, it seemed that Justice Kennedy, who's the court's swing vote, was very concerned about the consequences of reading the statute that way, because it will, among other things, really undermine the private insurance regime in those states, because private insurers are counting on the subsidies to maintain the market now that they have to provide universal insurance to people with pre-existing conditions.
It seems as though the sentiment on the part of the community in support of same-sex marriages believes that Obergefell v. Hodges is going to represent some huge milestone. And that may be the case, but it seems to me that this court is not interested particularly in big, broad milestone precedents, and that the divisions on this court may mean that this will be a much narrower decision. What do you believe?
Well, I think you're absolutely right to say that this court has been interested in taking small steps on basically every issue. I think the question when it comes to same-sex marriage is whether all the small steps have already been taken. And so there may not be much left for the court to do other than say that it is, in fact, discriminatory for courts to exclude gay and lesbian couples from marriage, for states to do that. And so I think their love of baby steps notwithstanding, this may be the last step that they have left.
Eric Citron is a partner at Goldstein & Russell. He's also a former clerk to Justices Sandra Day O'Connor and Elena Kagan and a guest contributor to the SCOTUS blog. Thanks so much for talking with us.
Thank you.
Support for The Takeaway comes from Curious.com, committed to helping people learn more than 15,000 skills like Hungarian, hula hooping, and HTML. Curious.com. Grow your skills. Learn more at curious.com/PRI.
President Obama talked about soccer today at the G7 summit in Germany. Soccer or football, he said, depending on which side of the Atlantic you're on, forgetting for a moment that Brazilians and Argentinians say football. Anyway, the president was asked for his reaction to the FIFA scandal, and he said he couldn't comment directly on an ongoing FBI investigation, but he did say this.
The United States, by the way, since we keep on getting better and better at each World Cup, you know, we want to make sure that a sport that's gaining popularity is conducted in an upright manner.
You might have mentioned the U.S. women's team. Unlike the men's game, where American teams have a hard time being relevant, the U.S. women's World Cup soccer team is a powerhouse. Last time the U.S. made it to the finals, it lost to Japan. And the Women's World Cup tournament is underway. This time around, two predictions. 538.com says the U.S. is the most likely to win, but not by much. While official FIFA rankings have Germany in the number one spot, the American team will face Australia first. Kat Whitehill joins us, retired professional soccer defender. She was a gold medalist at the 2004 Olympic Games in Athens and has played in two World Cups. She's now an announcer for Fox at the Women's World Cup tournament. Pretty exciting, all this, Kat, eh?
It's very exciting. I'm glad it's finally started here in Canada.
Do you think they've gone in as a favorite, the U.S. team?
Oh, absolutely. You know, it's hard to deny any tournament that the United States enters that they're not a favorite. I mean, they go in expecting to win every single game they play, and they typically do. So, you know, with this World Cup, there's a difference in their preparations and the look in their eyes that they want this more than I've seen them win in a long time.
Who are the returning veterans on the U.S. team?
Well, the main ones are players like Abby Wambach. She's, you know, been quoted saying if she doesn't win this World Cup, then, you know, that tarnishes her career. And she has a career where she's been FIFA World Player of the Year. She's won Olympic gold medals. She's the greatest goal scorer in the history of soccer, men and women. So she's had a pretty decent career. And yet this World Cup has been elusive for her. And so she really wants to win it. Carly Lloyd is another one that she's kind of the engine in the midfield that has scored two game winners in Olympics to win the gold medal. And she wants this World Cup as well. And other players like Hope Solo in the goal and Chrissy Rampone, who's the only returning player from the 1999 World Cup that won the World Cup. So the list goes on and on when it comes to veterans, which bodes well for this U.S. team.
What do you make of the bracket that the U.S. team is in? What's going to be the toughest competition?
Well, unfortunately for the United States, they're in what we like to call the group of death. And the reason for that is they're playing Sweden, who's in, you know, the top 10, Australia, who's in the top 10, and Nigeria, who is, for some reason, they're always in our group. I mean, I played them both times in the World Cups I was in, and they're just extremely difficult because of how athletic they are and fast. And, you know, it's just hard to beat them because even if you beat them once as a forward, you got to beat them one to two more times because they get back so quickly. And then after that, you know, if they continue to win, there's a possibility that, you know, they could meet the likes of Germany and France quite early in the tournament. And, you know, they're kind of the favorites as well. Everybody's either picking Germany or France, the United States to win. You know, so it's just extremely difficult for the United States to get through to the final. But the good news is that's how the United States like it. They want to play the best, and, you know, that way they can claim, when they do win, they can claim the trophy the right way.
Is this tournament a relief for FIFA, which gets to, you know, take a breath from all of the scandal that's transpired over the last few weeks? Is FIFA heavily involved in the women's game?
You know, I think relief is a good word for them. You know, it's one way to distract, you know, the people that are so involved in soccer, and, you know, just to look the other way and have a positive outlook on FIFA. And they are definitely involved with women's soccer. I mean, you know, it's taken a while, but they're getting there. And I mean, you know, you have to look back when Sepp Blatter was, you know, president a while ago for FIFA. He used to say that the only way for women to get viewers is if they wore tight shorts. And I think he's kind of, eating his words a little bit now, and he views this a little bit better. But, you know, for a lot of us women, you know, we're kind of happy to see him go just because, you know, Alex Morgan has been quoted that he didn't even know who she was when she was at the FIFA Player of the Year award. She was up for it, and he didn't even know her. So, you know, it's something that's been difficult when it comes to women, but, you know, FIFA has done an amazing job in, you know, helping us kind of get our foot in the door when it comes to soccer. And now they've expanded the field to, you know, 24 teams, which this is the first time it's ever been this big. So that's exciting for women's soccer. So FIFA is doing a nice job, but, you know, just be interesting to see who kind of takes the leadership role now.
As you've been watching really for a decade or so, have the crowds changed? Have they grown?
Yeah, they have actually. I mean, just, you know, 2011 was so huge for the U.S. when Abby Wambach scored that goal in the quarterfinals against Brazil, like latest goal ever in the World Cup. And, you know, unfortunately came in second, but still, it kind of revitalized the world when it comes to soccer and women's soccer. And their lead up game, their last game before 2011 in New York, they had 6,000 people, and just this past year, they had a sold-out crowd there in the same stadium of 26,000 people. So it's already starting to show that the fans are coming out. The American Outlaws are, you know, since Canada is so close to the U.S., the American Outlaws, which is the fan base of U.S. soccer, they're coming pretty heavily up here in Winnipeg. And so it's exciting to watch. And it took forever to get our order yesterday because, you know, Winnipeg wasn't ready for how many, you know, American fans were coming to this area. So it's great for the United States, and I love how much people are paying attention.
Finally, can the hometown team win?
I think so. I mean, they are peaking at the right time. They are, you know, playing really well. The key is they have to figure out a forward line. They have to get the forward scoring, and they have to find flank play. But I still believe it's between Germany, France, and the U.S. to who's it's to win. And I do think there's going to be some sleepers. Japan, I think Canada could play really well, the Netherlands. But, if the U.S. is playing at its best every single game, they're going to be hard to beat. It's going to be hard for them to beat the U.S.
Kat Whitehill is a retired professional soccer defender. She last played for the Boston Breakers. She's been following the women's game for more than a decade. Kat, thanks so much.
Yeah, thanks for having me on. It was great.
And before we go, lots of success for women athletes out there, and you're talking about it. Peter from Wyomissing, Pennsylvania. Serena, a player of regal grace and power, track, field hockey, martial arts, cycling, rowers, weightlifters, pure amateurs, but all the sacrifice and then some of publicized athletes, all guts, little or no glory, especially in the U.S. Serena Williams won the French Open on Saturday, claiming her 20th major. Wilmington, Delaware. Elena Deladon of WNBA, because she valued family more than fame and gave up UConn scholarships to be with her handicapped sister. Really a class act. Another good one from Wilmington. Elena plays for the Chicago Sky as a guard forward.
Hi, this is Jeff from Austin, Texas, and I think we should be celebrating Ronda Rousey. She's a world-class athlete and a great American success story that overcame many challenges in her life to get where she is, and an overall decent human being.
Hey, this is Richard from Congress, New York. I think we should also pay more attention to the United States women's hockey team because they're the best of the United States college girls in the world, and they also are always playing for the gold. Go USA!
Hi, this is Paul from New York, and I believe Billie Jean King should be honored because she was indeed a true trailblazer.
That's all for today, but you can respond to anything you heard on today's program. Call us at 877-8-MY-TAKE or comment at thetakeaway.org. You can always take The Takeaway with you. Subscribe to our podcast. Find us on iTunes. Take us with you on your commute, home from work, or whatever you're doing. It's a great way to stay up on the news. Again, find us on iTunes or any other service you use to get your podcasts. Thanks so much for listening. I'm John Hockenberry. This is The Takeaway.
PRI. Public Radio International.